Gazing through his binoculars, Hayden Lamarck watched the raiders walk away from the chimney rock. None of the Outlanders appeared to be in their midst. Wallace glanced at his commander.
Maybe they got away. If they'd killed the Outlanders, the raiders probably would have brought out the corpses.
Lamarck studied the raiders. All of them looked haggard and worn. None of them had any of the Outlanders' weapons, giving him even more reason to believe that the group had managed another escape. That possibility, however, was also daunting, because this final escape might have taken them from him as well. Lamarck lowered the binoculars, his expression calculating.
Don't appear to be as many of them as there was.
Not even half, I would say. Probably means they ran into the Outlanders somewhere up in those rocks.
And the Outlanders got away. Wallace, given that there's a point of entry to the river in those rocks, where do you figure they'd come out topside again?
4 or 5 miles away. But they'd be fools to try the river now, sir.
Why?
The blizzard last night. Come this morning, with the sun melting it all down the way it did, the river's going to be raging. There's places in the tunnels where the river goes that fills up sudden when a man least expects it. They went into it. There's every chance they're going to drown like rats before they get through it.
The sec boss watched the raiders making their way across the land almost 300 yards away. He wished he knew what was going on inside, hoping that Wallace was wrong about the Outlanders drowning. Light penetrated the water above Ryan's head. Weakened from lack of oxygen, battered by the river current and the stone channel it rushed through, he forced his body to work. He stroked for the surface, kicking as strong as he was able. He swiveled around to get his bearings. The river was gentler here, but continued to exert a steady pull. The cavern was also much wider, 60 or 70 feet at least, and the water touched every wall. Stalactites lined the uneven rooftop nearly 20 feet above. Cracks opened the dome in places, allowing thin streamers of yellow light to pour in. Ryan saw JB and Mildred less than 20 feet away. They managed on their own, clinging to each other while treading water. Hoyle bobbed to the surface behind them.
Dry lands over that way.
JB looked around, managing to hang onto his fedora while he floated.
Where's Doc, Jack, and Christy?
Don't know. Now look.
Ryan dove down, kicking violently, knowing they were running out of time. He met Christy, who was coming up, pulling the slack form of Doc after her, barely illuminated in the ghostly water. Grabbing a shoulder of the old man's frock coat, Ryan helped Christy swim to the surface.
Let me have him.
Christy nodded, breaking away and treading water. Ryan levered an arm under Doc's chin and started for shore. Dean lay on his back on his bed in the boys' dorm, his hands clasped behind his head. On the top bunk, he was almost lifted from the general hubbub from his roommates. He focused on a fly clinging to the ceiling. Maybe it wouldn't have been so bad to have been born a fly. And flies, Dean noted, seemed to be happiest when they were face deep in a pile of shit, which was exactly where Dean figured he was.
Uh-oh! Someone's coming! Tidy up!
The other boys dashed madly around, cleaning up their bunks. Dean didn't move, even when he saw Headmaster Brody. There wasn't any way he could get into more trouble.
Boys, I'd like to pass a few moments with Mr. Carter, if I may. Alone.
Immediately, the three boys jumped up and herded out into the hallway, relief evident in the way they carried themselves. As the door shut, Dean sat up on the bed, his bare feet dangling over the edge. He'd showered that morning, and his hair was still damp. He wore only the school-designated t-shirt and pants.
I really wish you had not ventured up onto that building, Mr. Carter. Really, I wish you had not.
What's going to happen to me, sir, for what I did?
That remains to be seen, lad. I am faced with a most difficult situation. Mr. Ventnor was summarily excused from the rest of his classes this year over his father's insistent arguments and hostilities. He'll not be returning to this school without due attention in regards to the situation, nor without an official apology to this institution and to Miss Lemon, but that was due in part to his own licentious behavior and how he handled the whole affair, as well as his father's bullheadedness.
Is that what's going to happen to me?
Dean felt his stomach lurch. He didn't realize how much he was going to miss the school, or how much the idea that he could get kicked out sickened him. Brody turned to look at him, his gaze bright and direct.
I find myself in quite a quandary in regards to you. You lied to me by omission, telling me you knew not what led you to stray to that building this morning. Surely the response of an irresponsible and churlish boy. Yet you stepped forward when Miss Lemon's integrity was in danger of becoming forfeit. An act of a young gentleman who knows there must be a recompense for actions foolishly taken, who understands the importance of protecting the innocent as well as the importance of fair play. Neither Mr. Ventnor nor his progenitor handled the situation with even a fraction of the courage you exhibited.
Will I be allowed to stay?
I don't know, lad. I'll have to think on it. Punishment in these regards must be strictly adhered to, else the student body at this institution will run amok, and even more stringent measures will need to be applied to bring them into line once more. I set those standards, and I don't mean to see them broken.
Yes, sir.
Keep your chin up, Mr. Carter. However it turns out, you've kept at least a portion of my respect today. A most important portion, I might add. And maybe earn self-respect in your own eyes, that you will see once we are days past this present encumbrance. I shall try to get word to your father by the means I have open to me, and we shall see what must be done. Until then, you'll be confined to your quarters.
Yes, sir.
Brody turned, opened the door, and departed. Dean tossed himself back onto his bed. He felt like crying, something he hadn't allowed himself to do in a long time. At the same time, he felt like kicking down the walls of his room. Instead, he lay on his back and threw a forearm across his eyes to block out his vision.
Carter! Dean Carter!
Dean unwrapped his arm from his eyes. He craned his head around and looked at the doorway. Ethan Perry, tall and muscled, a blue-black undercoating of beard and mustache still showing through fresh-shaven chin, stood looking in at him.
What do you want?
Perry smiled. He had the easy confidence of the natural athlete. Some few months short of 18, Perry was the most gifted of those in the phys ed class at the school. Whenever a game was played, football, baseball, or dodgeball, everyone wanted to be on Perry's side.
Heard about what happened this morning. I know Ventnor's too gutless to do something like that, so I figured it was you put together the raid on the girls' dorm. Pretty clever.
Dean just looked at the other boy, hardly breathing. Perry had a group of 10 boys that he ran roughshod over. They were the best the school had to offer when it came to sports. They ate together, slept in the same dorms, and did their studying together. When one of them scored low on a test, the others pitched in to help him study harder so the group remained unbroken. No other team the school fielded was ever able to defeat Perry's team. However, in individual effort, Dean bested several, if not all, of the 10 boys. Sometimes that included Perry himself. Dean kept a blank face, trying to figure out why a guy who didn't like him was talking to him like they were friendly, if not friends. Perry leaned against the door, as if he had all day.
Me and my buddies are doing some exercises tonight with Mr. Solomon, the new phys ed teacher. Thought maybe you'd like to join us.
Why me?
Mr. Solomon thought it might be a good idea. Me, I don't think we need you, but he was pretty insistent. Conover busted a rib this morning during one of our martial arts sessions. Mr. Solomon wanted you to fill in tonight.
Doing what?
Does it matter?
Does Mr. Solomon know I've been told to stay in my quarters?
Probably. Doesn't appear to be anybody gonna make sure that's what you do. So I guess whether you stay or go is mostly up to you.
A well of resentment opened up in Dean. He'd been more or less abandoned at the school by his dad, even after he'd voiced an objection to coming there. He'd minded most of the bigger rules, his mostly minor infractions more inconsiderate than rebellious. It wasn't until he'd gone to see Phaedra Lemon that things seemed to come apart.
If I get caught, will Mr. Solomon talk to Mr. Brody for me?
Fuck that! None of us are gonna get caught. We'll even teach you to be more sly than you were this morning.
Listening to the other boy made Dean feel better. Maybe something good had come out of getting caught sneaking around after all. Of all the student body, Perry and his group seemed to be the most like Dean. They were fierce, hard, rough, and feared throughout the school. They weren't pampered kids at all. Used to being a loner, Dean hadn't tried overly hard to take up with the group. but he wouldn't have objected to an offer of friendship or interest on their behalf. Mr. Solomon had never before tried to pair any of Perry's group with him.
So what's it gonna be? If you don't want to do it, I gotta ask somebody else.
What time am I supposed to be there?
I'll come get you when it's time. Mr. Solomon said it'll be after dark. And try to sleep this afternoon if you can, because we're gonna be out most all night.
Perry smiled and headed out. Dean lay back on the bed, excited and scared at the same time, and wondering what Mr. Solomon had in mind. Skulking around in the dark, though, sounded good to him no matter what the excuse. He closed his eyes, and after a time, slept. Ryan trudged through the waist-deep water looking for Jack, the only person missing. Hoyland Burnson waited after him, with Christy keeping them covered.
How long you gonna go looking for the boy?
As far as it takes, Hoyle.
Him holding onto that raft like he was, he could be anywhere. Hell, if he drowned, he might not be stopped yet.
I'll take that chance.
There's all sorts of mutie creatures in here. Leaving your friends back there wasn't any too smart either, if you ask me.
Didn't ask.
Ryan kept moving, ducking under an overhang of crooked, lichen-covered rock that jutted from the cavern wall. The cavern was continuing to widen slightly, allowing more light in from cracks across the ceiling. The river appeared to be moving slower, but still at a steady clip.
They haven't been attacked.
How do you know?
JB would have blasted anything that tried. Would have heard that.
What do you intend to do with us?
Depends, Burnson.
Depends? What kind of answer is that? My God, that's no answer.
It's the only one I've got for you. You and your friend here know this river, and I can use knowledge like that. How far does the cave system go?
This one goes on for a couple miles more. Then you have some daylight for another 15 miles or so. Another cave system after that where you have to make a decision about where you want to go. The river forks in three directions and continues on for various distances.
As far as Colorado?
Yeah. What's in Colorado?
My son. So no arguments out of you. Now maybe you want to tell me what you're doing up here.
Working a job, guiding Berenson and his friends.
Ryan followed the turn of the river, going cautious, the Sig Sauer covering the terrain ahead of him. Only parts of the cavern lay in shadow, and beams of sunlight from crevices in the ceiling glinted silver off the unsettled river. To Ryan's relief, the land sloped upward a bit, dropping the water to his knees.
What kind of friends?
Scientists. All of them's been killed except Berenson. Three were killed by the raiders a few days ago. Two died from some mutie critter's poison. A man named Melilin fell and broke his neck when we were trying to beat out the storm.
Saw a tattoo on Melilin. Spotted one on Burnson, too. And you.
They got a thing about identifying each other. In some places, they ain't too welcome. 10-15 years ago, old David Napier tried telling a few folks up north to be on the lookout for certain things. Some of those folks took objection to what he was preaching. Called him a heretic, strung him up. Made the other people of the Heimdall Foundation kind of shy about being noticed.
Heard mention of that Heimdall name. What is it, this foundation?
You'd have to ask Burnson to get the real particulars of that. Basically, these people use telescopes and stare up at the sky all night long. They got books, vids, and some comp progs that talk about all that stuff up there. Call it astronomy.
All that looking, they gotta be looking for something.
Falling stars.
That what brought you from Montana?
How do you know about Montana?
Melilin had a map. Heimdall Point was marked on it.
Well, that's a fool thing to do. I hope you took up that map.
Yep.
Don't need something like that falling into unfriendly hands. The Heimdall Foundation ain't set up proper to repel an attack. These poor bastards. They've been in their damn little towers too long looking up at the sky, if you ask me. I've been guiding these assholes around a few places, going here and there for the last 4 years. Pays good. I get some jack at the end of every trek, successful or not, and I manage to steal enough pre-dark stuff along the way to hawk through some friends I got in a few places to keep myself living comfortable. Over the last few months, they took a special interest in a star they started calling Shostakovich's Anvil.
Twisted name for a star.
That's what I thought. But they don't ask me before they go naming them. And the way they talked, it sounded like somebody else had already named this one.
Might not have such an easy job when you get back there with a few scientists short.
Hell, ain't none of us loose yet. I figure we won't be clear of the reach of the Five Barons for a while.
Who are the Five Barons?
Now that's a story. In the beginning, there'd been a gathering of small vills along the Pacific coast. Each had clung to ideals and traditions handed down from those who'd survived the Nuke Cost, or had migrated there afterward to be near the ocean where there were still fish. Man's gotta eat, right? Anyway, the vills didn't get along. Each had staked out territorial claims that had been disputed over the years. Several vills had split off from the original vill. One died out from an epidemic that created a natural southern boundary. After that, things remained peaceable. Until the arrival of the Barons. Any of them Barons you ask about, you're going to hear a different story about how and why they came to be trapped out in the deserts the way they were. Only them and their maker and a handful of their close sect people know the right of it. All of the Barons, six of them at the time, wandered in from the desert, drawn by tales they'd heard of the vills and how robbing was easy there because the people in the seven vills were too busy raising stuff to eat and fishing to worry about learning to fight. When the Barons got among the vills, greed had set in. The vills were too close to allow for expansion by each separate Baron. They tried splitting them up, but none of them were men who wanted to share. They went to war with each other, fighting, killing, and sabotaging, the like of which none of the people of the Seven Vills had ever seen before. Oh, they'd had their scraps over the years, but it wasn't nothing like what the Barons could dish out against each other. But with the Barons killing one another and reducing their manpower down to something that wouldn't allow them to stand firm against the Muti bands wandering in the desert if they had to return there, they struck a bargain. Only one of the Barons could comfortably run the Seven Vills at one time. So they decided a competition was in order to figure out who was going to get control without killing each other. All of them were so aligned that if any one of them swore out a blood feud against another, the others would step in and stop it. A shift in the balance of power wasn't tolerated. Jake Maston, the old sixth Baron, was the only man all five of the others couldn't stand. They killed him 3 years ago and became known as the Five Barons. They got together and created the Big Game. Found a place out in the desert, somewhere that held a lot of meaning to it at one time. A place where luck and chance came together, they tell me. I never seen it.
What do they do there?
Choose up teams, kidnap folk, and use them to fight for them. Control of the Seven Vills for the next year goes to the Baron whose team wins.
What does the winning team get?
Killed, mostly. Except for one man, or woman, or Muti. The Barons ain't particular. They don't want anybody to get a chance at getting together an experienced team, you know.
So why do those people fight?
Don't give them much choice at the time.
Ryan turned the story over in his head as he walked through water that diminished to inches deep instead of feet deep.
Which Baron is in charge now? And who's his sect boss?
Baron Hardco. Lamarck's his most loyal man, but not the only sect boss. Hardco probably has a half dozen of them. Got a lot of men with him. But the Big Game is coming soon, and we'll decide who's going to get control of the Seven Vills for the next year.
Ryan thought of the mysterious rifle shot that had nailed one of the raiders before he and JB had caught up to their companions.
That was Lamarck out there behind us?
Yep, behind you and the raiders. Spotted him through the telescopic sights of the Sharps.
And you'd know him?
Met him last week. Sort of. Ernson and his friends thought that star was going to drop somewhere near the Seven Vills. I explained to them that nothing went on in that area unless it was okayed by the Barons. So they marched into Jake's town, pretty as you please, and asked Hardco for permission to stay for a couple days. I've always heard he was interested on pre-dark learnings, and I guess it must be so, because he not only let him stay, but hell, he even put him up.
Why would Hardco be up here?
Last I heard, Baron Hardco assigned Lamarck to bring in the raider leader. Doherty's been raiding some of the farmers in the vills, and Hardco takes his business serious.
So he could have been after Doherty?
Maybe, but from what I saw, he seemed to be showing a lot of interest in you people.
Ryan didn't have an explanation for that, but he let it drift around in the back of his mind while they walked.
Hey, what's that up ahead?
Ryan looked where Hoyle pointed and spotted the raft, tucked up mostly out of sight behind and under some driftwood. Jack was just one shadow among myriad others, until he stepped out into view with a leaf-bladed throwing knife in one hand and his .357 Magnum in the other.
Knew you'd come soon. Waited. Too damn hard to put a raft back up the river alone.
By the time everyone had regrouped to a part of the cave that had actual land, not underwater, Christy ached all over. She hadn't rested well the night before, and she'd taken a turn at pulling the raft part way, which had started out easy, then gotten to be serious work as they approached the faster-running water still pouring into the river. She was relieved to see Doc drinking some soup from a self-heat, and his color looked much improved.
Much better.
Ryan made sure that the Heimdall men sat with their backs against the wall, about 10 feet away, before he approached the rest of the companions.
JB, did you see anything while you were guarding the back trail?
Nope. Saw no sign of anybody who was looking for us. Unless you count a body that came through about an hour ago. Looked like a raider, but I didn't wait out to go check. But the river seems to be slowing some.
We have another problem. We've walked into an annual combat between 5 barons, designed to decide who rules their bunch of vills for a year. Hoyle says the current leader, Hardco, has got his segment on our trail. Name of Lamarck.
If he was tracking the raiders, could be he found us then. We weren't able to take in everything going on behind us.
But why get interested in us? We've never been through those vills.
I don't know.
Maybe Lamarck and his sect men aren't looking for us at all. Reckon they could have been on the trail of these Heimdall people just as much as they were after the raiders.
Yeah, but why? They've been to the vills. They're tracking some star or other called Shostakovich's anvil and went to tell the barons about it. But we found nothing in either one of those men's equipment that looked valuable.
Perhaps their interest lies in the cartographic discovery we made in the Dead Man's Pack. This Heimdall Foundation sounds intriguing. Mayhap Baron Hardco thought so as well.
In Montana? That's way the hell out of his usual beat, sounds like to me.
True. But follow my mental perambulations for a moment, if you will. A group of scientists with no standing army of their own, but clearly amenities enough to allow for intellectual endeavor. If he loses his current position of leadership, the Heimdall Foundation would be a place to go.
Makes sense.
That does. What doesn't is why Hardco didn't just capture the Heimdall Foundation scientists when they were in Isville and be done with it. Hang on. Hey, Burnson, get over here.
Burnson sidled over to the group, not looking happy about it at all.
Tell me about Shostakovich's anvil.
I don't have to answer you.
No? How about I cut you, and when you're bleeding real good, throw you in the river, just to see what comes to check out what's for dinner.
The man dragged a hand over his round face, sweating profusely from fear, exertion, and the humidity trapped in the cavern.
Shostakovich's anvil was a Soviet space station. It was put up before the nuke cost and was supposed to collect data. And aside from the knowledge collected, it's also interesting if you remember the chaotic nature of the world at that time. Nations aligning themselves with the two superpowers, not to mention the alien menace. Not everyone believed that aliens who came back to the planet would be friendly.
As I recall, there were plenty of numbers in either camp who believed aliens would be mankind's greatest friend or its most loathsome enemy.
Yes, all-out struggle for supremacy. And then, bang! We almost encountered the end. But our ancestors survived the new cost, and they started the Heimdall Foundation. Most of the electronic equipment at that time was exposed to the electromagnetic pulse from the nuclear weapons. Nothing worked. They struggled together and managed to find enough telescopes and comps to survey the night sky and to record their findings. They also added to their treasure trove with books, comp progs, vids, and buried government files.
You've been tracking these falling satellites. If you were tracking them, what were you doing in the 7 vills?
We've acquired conflicting data over the years. And even with the comps we've put together, we've in no way been able to do the space monitoring they did in the pre-dark times. Where the Soviet space station was going to land was open to conjecture. But we narrowed it down to 2 places.
Jakestown.
Yes. Depending on atmospheric conditions, which we're not too exact on.
Where's the other place?
About 40 miles north and slightly east of this position. There's a lake. Pyramid Lake. It should be on any maps you've got.
JB opened his map and traced the surface with a forefinger.
Got it.
How did you plan on getting there?
Yeah, this river goes most of the way. There's perhaps a 12-mile hike over some rough country in Smoke Creek Desert.
How rough?
Burnson glanced at Hoyle, who shrugged and moved closer.
Man's got no water, he's dead. Got no fire at night, he's dead. You burn to death during the day, freeze your goddamn ass off at night. Not much to eat or drink either. Country's still carrying a taint of rad blasting from farther east.
Burnson, when's the space station going to come down?
2 days from now, an hour or two after nightfall.
How sure are you?
I came out here to see it. 6 other people from the Foundation died getting this far. We're pretty certain.
It seems to me that this is not only a once-in-a-lifetime experience, but could be deeply important with regard to information. If the station survives re-entry in some fashion, the data that could be salvaged could be of immense value by several measures.
Everybody get your gear together. We're leaving in 5 minutes.
The moon was hidden behind a cloud bank when Dean and Perry joined up with the rest of Perry's group in the forest beyond the school's cultivated fields. Mr. Solomon, tall and angular, with a long, thick mustache that curled down from his upper lip, stood in front of them. He was dressed in black as well, but had double pistol holsters with revolvers shoved into them.
You're late, Mr. Perry. Won't happen again, sir.
Dean fell into line with the other boys, but his hackles raised a little. Authority didn't suit him, and Solomon was more by the book than any of the teachers at the school. There were some rumors that Solomon had a background in sec work somewhere farther west, maybe even as far as the Pacific Ocean coastline. Solomon flicked his dead gaze on Dean and crossed the space to stand in front of him.
Glad you could join us, Mr. Carter. I hadn't planned on the unfortunate incident that removed Mr. Conover from our midst this morning. Tonight's activities, though, require 10 players. I've never seen you operate in the dark. How good are you?
I'm okay.
I guess we'll have the truth of that in short order.
Solomon walked back down the line, his hands clasped behind his back, his spine rigid and his shoulders squared. He met each boy's gaze in turn.
Tonight's exercise requires cunning and stealth. Follow me.
Dean went with the others and trailed after Solomon. The phys ed instructor came to a stop on a small promontory overlooking rugged terrain filled with trees, brush, and hills. He pointed at 5 of the boys, then presented them with blue handkerchiefs.
Put those in your belts. Loose enough to pull out, but not loose enough to fall out on their own.
The 5 boys tucked the handkerchiefs in their belts, testing them for tightness.
The exercise works like this. The 5 of you with the blue flags will be given a minute head start. Your goal is the tree out there.
Dean followed the phys ed teacher's finger, spotting the tall Colorado blue spruce nearly a half mile away. A white banner fluttered near its top.
Then the others will follow. I want you to use stealth, not speed, traversing that terrain. Some of you could run that distance in 3-4 minutes. Shadows are all over the place out there. One misstep, and you can end up with a broken leg or a broken foot or worse. I don't want to get anyone hurt out there, or screw up this team any more than it has been after this morning. Is that clear?
Yes, sir!
Those of you who are pursuing the flag bearers, your assignment is to take their flag by whatever means you have at your disposal. Yes, Mr. Perry?
How physical can we get?
Short of permanent damage? Bruises and small cuts I can explain. You do anything more than that, and this unit and its status will be in danger at this school.
Hercules Moxon, another student, eyed the flag in the distance. He was close to 6 feet tall, almost a head taller than Dean, and had fiery red hair. Not all of his substantial weight was muscle, but there was enough to give most grown men pause. He bared his teeth in a grin and looked at Mr. Solomon.
What do we get for reaching the tree with our flag?
You don't have to do the extra PT the others will for failing to catch you.
What do we get if we catch them?
Looking down the line, Dean saw that the speaker was Lewis McKenzie. Of all the boys in Perry's group, Dean liked Lewis best. The boy always had a smile and a gentle way about him, if he cared to show it. He was blonde and had light green eyes that belonged on a cat, and he was a little taller than Dean, but built in the same lanky fashion.
Then they get extra PT. Some incentive both ways. After we do this once, we'll do it again, and the pursued will become the pursuers. Everybody ready?
Yes, sir!
Solomon paired the boys off, giving each of them a target. Dean got Hercules Moxon. The other boy smirked and shook his head as if he couldn't believe it.
See you at the tree, small fry. When you're doing the extra PT, think of me.
Dean shrugged. Talk was just talk. His dad had taught him that. Despite Solomon's warning not to simply head for the tree, Dean figured Moxon would try to reach the tree as quick as he was able.
Go!
The first five boys launched themselves into the darkness and the underbrush.
Team 2, stand by!
Dean watched Moxon until the boy vanished behind a triangular pine tree and the minute ticked by.
Team 2, go!
Dean bolted, already moving at top speed, trusting his night vision and reflexes to keep him from serious damage. He pumped his feet against the ground, swinging his arms at his sides. It felt good to be out, testing himself against someone else, deep in the wild, where his primitive senses could take care of him, instead of social skills that he didn't feel as confident about. He ran, convinced he was closing the distance, using every skill he'd ever been taught, skirting plants, trees, and bushes that would have warned of his passage had he touched them. He tried to listen for Hercules Moxon, but couldn't hear the boy. The terrain was uneven and dangerous, and the cloud-covered moon cast no light. He was two steps up the rise before he knew it was there and stumbled, but caught himself. When he got to the top of the small hill, he spotted Moxon sprawled face down at the bottom of it, arms flung out to his sides, one leg twisted over the other.
Oh, shit!
Dean figured it was just his luck. He had been remanded to his room, and now here he was finding Moxon probably dead. He threw himself to the ground beside Moxon, not even thinking for a moment that the bigger boy was just fooling him. Moxon's legs were too twisted for that, and it had to be painful. If nothing was broken, it had been a close call. Dean grabbed the boy's shoulder, turning him gently. The youth rolled over loosely, dirt smeared against his pallid cheeks. The boy's eyes were halfway open, glinting dully in the weak moonlight. Drool oozed out of one corner of his mouth, mixing with the weak traces of blood. He blew out white bubbles of spittle and moved one arm, struggling to speak.
What's wrong?
Dean leaned closer and spotted the small, feathered dart stuck deep in Moxon's neck. A chill slid down Dean's back. He tried not to act as if he'd seen it. Throwing himself to one side, Dean rolled, coming up on his feet so he could look back in the direction he'd heard the footstep. A dark figure, barely discernible in the black clothing and standing in the tree line less than 40 feet away, took aim with a long-barreled weapon. A ruby dot appeared, smack in the middle of Dean's chest. He dropped instantly, squatting and placing the palms of his hands against the ground. Shoving himself up again, Dean ran, heading back toward the starting area. Whoever the hell that was, he evidently had been waiting for the boys to come breaking through the brush, or he'd come after them. That new thought didn't sit well with Dean as he ran, making him more cautious. His shoulders tightened up as he expected to feel one of the darts pierce his skin.
What the fuck is going on?
Ow!
Dean listened as he ran and realized there was more than one attacker. He reached out for the slender bole of a pine tree and swung himself in a tight curve. While he had his hand on the tree, he felt a feathered dart sink into the rough bark between his fingers. Dean stayed with the pine trees as long as he could, but then he was all out of trees, with the ridge line leading back at the starting point 70 yards away. He zigzagged, risking a glance over his shoulder that showed his pursuer breaking out of the brush 20 yards behind him. Dean made it to the top of the ridge and saw Mr. Solomon standing there in the shadow of a tree and holding binoculars to his face. Dean sprinted toward the phys ed teacher.
Mr. Solomon, something's gone wrong.
Solomon turned his head, dropping the binoculars to his side.
There are men out there shooting at us.
I know.
Dean skidded to a stop.
You did it! You betrayed us!
Yes.
In a blur, Solomon unleathered his weapon and fired a silenced shot. Incredulous, he glanced down at the feathered dart sticking out of his body. He reached for it, feeling the pain already going away as numbness spread throughout his torso. Then his legs wouldn't hold him anymore, and he fell to the ground. A wave of sudden nausea jerked Christy upright in the raft. She clapped a hand over her mouth and swallowed a ball of bile that had risen to her throat. Doc leaned forward and grasped her arm.
Christy, my dear, are you all right?
She couldn't answer. Her stomach still rolled. She kept her hand over her mouth as she struggled to the side of the raft. Trees lined the riverbanks on both sides. Jack and Ryan were scouting at the top of the nearby hill to get their bearings. Christy clambered to the side of the raft, Hoyland Burnson parted and made room for her. JB aimed the Uzi at them, just to let them know they didn't dare make a move on Christy or try to take her weapon. Mildred turned to look at her, concern on her face.
Need some help?
Christy kept her lips together until she had her head over the raft's side. Sitting up, she shivered, goosebumps pimpling her skin. She felt suddenly drained of all strength. Mildred slipped a hand over her forehead and wrapped an arm around her shoulders to help support her.
Christy, what's wrong?
I don't know.
Something you ate?
I ate out of the same batch of self-heats as everyone else did. No one else seems sick.
You don't have a fever?
I don't feel hot. Just sick. My head hurts. My vision's blurry and that ringing. God, do you hear that ringing?
No ringing. Do you feel dizzy?
Some.
Christy reached into the brackish water, cupped a handful, and smeared it over her face. It cooled her a little, but not enough to take the real edge off the flush she felt. Mildred continued to support her. Without the other woman's help, Christy didn't think she could have stayed up at all. She felt boneless, totally lethargic. Feeling her stomach roll again, she leaned back over the side of the raft and splashed a second handful of water on her face. When she blinked the droplets from her eyes, she thought she saw something centered in the ripples spreading out from the raft. Hazy and wavering, an image coalesced.
Dean.
He seemed to float on the water before her, his face slack, empty, and pale.
Oh, Gaia.
She tried to hang on to the vision, make it clearer so she could see where the boy was. But she just got an impression that he was outside, surrounded by brush and long grass. Then the image dissolved and faded away, leaving nothing but light reflecting back at her.
No.
What is it, my dear?
It's Dean. He looked dead. Gaia, Doc, he looked dead.
As quickly as it had come, the nausea left Christy. All she felt now was cold and empty. She wrapped her arms around herself as she trembled. Mildred took a blanket from one of the backpacks Hoyland Burnson had been carrying, then draped it around Christy's shoulders.
Shh, calm down. You don't know that for sure.
Christy dropped her chin onto her chest and closed her eyes. That was a mistake, because the image of Dean came swirling back into her head, all mixed up with a vision she'd had the day before.
If I may, could he have been asleep?
Not asleep. I've seen him asleep. It wasn't anything like this. He was too pale, and he was outside somewhere.
Well, then mayhap he was sick, and you saw him at that time. It might not be something that is going on now at all. You might be able to find out.
I don't know if I can do that. I lost him, and I couldn't hang on to that image anymore.
Don't try for an image. You yourself have said if anything happened to Ryan, you would know. And you believe that tie goes beyond just yourself and Ryan.
Christy nodded, not feeling as lost. It was a thought to hold on to. Doc reached out and took one of her hands.
To allay your feelings and fears, you should try to reach out to Dean.
I know you're right, Doc, but I'm still afraid.
The only thing to fear is the unknown, not the truth. I know not what happened to my own family, and I would give anything to have that peace of knowing for sure. There comes a time when what you're supposed to do is lay down the burdens you've been carrying. And fear, dear lady, is a huge burden to bear. You've been given enough of them of late.
Reluctantly, Christy closed her eyes and concentrated on Dean. She built his face in her mind the way she'd seen it thousands of times. So like Ryan, that she could see part of what her lover had to have been like as a child. Despite Ryan's irritation with Dean over behavior on occasion, there wasn't so much separating the father and son. Christy squeezed Doc's hand as she found what she was searching for. Dean was out there, though his presence wasn't as strong and vibrant as it normally was. She reached out to him and felt his aliveness before her concentration broke and the feeling faded. She opened her eyes, tears of relief sliding down her cheeks.
Christy?
It's okay, Doc. He's alive.
You sure?
Yes, but he felt very tired to me.
Just you rest easy, dear lady. Ryan will return in a short while, and things will seem better.
Christy pulled the blanket around her tighter, trying to stave off the chill still threatening to consume her. Her head ached, but she kept her gaze focused on the dark and forbidding forest around them, afraid to close her eyes because of what she might see if she did. Full consciousness returned to Dean slowly, flickering in by dribs and drabs. His head hurt, and he could feel his heartbeat throbbing in his ears and his neck.
I checked, Baron, and the boys appear to be all right. No permanent injuries, nothing that would keep them from being of service to you.
All 10 are there?
Yes.
Dean slitted his eyes open. Weak yellow light filtered through canvas that was over his head. He could already tell he was lying on a hard surface. Not the ground, though.
You say this group has been trained together, Solomon?
For just short of 10 months.
This one looks kind of skinny.
Something hard pressed into Dean's side, and he closed his eyes, clamping his lips shut against a cry of pain.
Don't worry about him, Baron. Bastard kid there as quick as lightning. Had him in my sights, and he wheeled on me as I was squeezing the trigger. Disappeared like a fucking ghost, and was gone before I could draw another bead.
So he can run. Don't need a runner, need a fighter.
He can fight. He's a chiller.
Know that for a fact, do you?
If that boy had gotten his hands on a weapon, you might not have had all your men back out of the brush. If he hadn't trusted me just long enough, I wouldn't have bagged him for you.
Dean slitted his eyes open again. This time he saw the wall of bars separating him from the speakers. Solomon stood next to a gruff-looking man in road leathers, the right side of his face spiderwebbed with tattoos, a rifle resting easy in the crook of his arm. The Baron stood to one side, but Dean couldn't see his face. Beyond them, another dozen were making final preparations on the wags that had formed a loose circle around the area.
Moves like that, Baron? You can't teach in kiddie school. Boy's been around some.
Give me that light.
The Baron took a cylinder from the man beside him, switched it on, and fanned the lens out into a broad cone. With the extra light, Dean could see that he was in a wag of some type. The top was covered by canvas over a ribcage of bars, just like the ones covering the back end, converting the wag to a cage on wheels. Slavers used vehicles like these when they could. His heartbeat sped up. Solomon had sold them out to slavers. The other boys were sitting around him. A few were still out cold, but the rest had thrown off the effects of the trank dart they'd been hit with. The Baron strode to the end of the wag, then stepped up on a platform mounted there. The wag shifted as it took on the man's weight. Framed in the light, he directed at the top of the canvas-covered cage. The Baron looked fierce. His face was carved by hard living in mean times, scraped free of any softness or empathy. Long black hair framed his face and ran down past his shoulders. A mustache and goatee almost disguised the old knife scar that ran across his cruel lips. Another scar started from the bottom of the goatee and trailed down the side of his neck, showing how close he'd come to death. He wore jeans with wraparound black chaps over them, a body armor vest with a death's head painted over his heart, a deep turquoise silk shirt with a high collar under that. Feathered earrings thatched with blue jay quills hung from either side of his head. A cut-down Mossberg Bullpup 12 shotgun rode in a hand-tooled breakout holster that ran the length of the man's right thigh. The butt sawed off and replaced with a fold-out metal stock. He carried a Detonix 45 caliber in shoulder leather.
I'm Baron Vinge Conrad, and that probably don't mean a thing to most of you. What does matter is that I own you as of this minute. You can live or die right now. What's it gonna be?
He slipped the Mossberg free of the thigh holster and held it in one hand.
I better damn sure get an answer. Otherwise, I'm gonna shoot me some fish in a barrel.
Ethan Perry looked up, dried blood on his split lip.
Live! Live! Live!
Dean, who'd said nothing, found himself being prodded with a shotgun muzzle. He thought about trying to grab the barrel, but decided against it. Even if he managed to get it away from the man, there was nowhere to go.
What about you, kid?
I want to live.
Conrad flashed him a cruel grin, eyes shadowed by the night's darkness, and withdrew the Mossberg.
Smart kid.
Dean sat up, sidling out of arm's reach.
What do we have to do to live?
Chill a few people, nothing big.
Who?
Doesn't matter.
Dean dropped his arms over his folded knees and stared unblinkingly at the Baron.
Not really.
I like this kid, Solomon.
Knew you would. Like to talk about the jack you owe me for training these kids for you?
Conrad waved a dismissive hand, turning his gaze back to Dean.
You're kind of the runt of the litter, kid. Like Solomon said, I paid him some good jack for finding 10 of you here at the school with guts and putting you together as a team. Promised him more when he delivered you. Been thinking about that, though. Saunders!
Instantly, the gruff man with the face tattoos put a gun to Solomon's head, then quickly relieved him of his weapons.
Put your hands up and keep them there. What the hell's going on?
Got to thinking about it. You don't want to go to Vegas with us, and that leaves me kind of exposed. You might tell some of Brody's people about this transaction. Maybe old Brody's an honorary enough cuss to send somebody looking for us. Can't have that.
Wait a minute. If I sell you out, I'm writing my own death sentence. Even if you didn't hunt me down, Brody or one of those town folks would.
Maybe. And maybe you'd cut some kind of deal if you got caught getting out of this territory. Town folk get kind of soft. Forget those hard roots that got them as far as they are. If you came with us, I know you'd got free of the situation. But you didn't want it that way.
I'll go. I'll go with you. It's not that big a deal.
Conrad fixed Dean with his stare.
You believe him?
Dean looked deep into the phys ed teacher's eyes, thinking about the way Solomon had betrayed Nicholas Brody, the school, and the 9 other boys sitting in the cage behind him.
No.
Lad after my own heart. You figure old Solomon would up and split the first chance he got?
Yeah.
So do I. You think I should just shoot that pale, shaking son of a bitch and be done with it?
Up to you.
Conrad abruptly passed the light to another man, then worked the shotgun slide to eject 5 shells.
Got one left in there. You hard enough to shoot Solomon for what he done?
Dean returned the Baron's flat gaze full measure. Nothing stirred inside him. It was all about survival now.
Yeah.
Carter, you can't do that! You cold-hearted little son of a bitch!
Sit down or I'll blow your bastard head off!
Conrad held the detonics in his other hand and pointed it directly at Perry's head.
Get off of me!
Other boys, including Moxon and Lewis McKenzie, reached up for Perry and pulled him back down. Perry put up a struggle, but it was mostly show. There wasn't any way he was going to go up against the Baron's pistol. Dean smelled the raw stink of fear filling the wag cage.
Want to do it?
Dean imagined his father in his shoes, willing himself to step into his dad's way of thinking. It was all about here and now, living to take one more breath, and not regretting what he had to do to take it.
Up to you. You're in charge.
Conrad passed the Mossberg through the bars. Dean took it, keeping his hand out of the trigger guard. The gun felt solid, dependable. He thought about the one round in the magazine, wondering if it was really there. The Baron pointed the detonics at Dean.
Go ahead and do it.
Slowly, Dean brought the shotgun to bear on the Baron's chest. He peered intently at the man over the barrel, neither of them backing off. Dean continued to stare across the length of the shotgun at Baron Vinge Conrad, not letting himself feel anything. Several of the Baron's sekmen started forward, drawing their weapons.
Stay back! What are you gonna do, kid?
Depends.
On what?
Whether you're a slaver. I got no wish to be a slave. Rather die. Guess we could find out who's faster.
You'd be dead.
And free.
If you believe in any kind of life after this one. Do you?
Don't know. Maybe if I'm fast enough, we could go see together.
Dean forced himself to keep from shaking. His finger stayed away from the trigger.
God, but you're a mean kid. I could have sired you myself. I'm no slaver. Got some chilling work for you to do. After that, you go free. My word on it.
If I told you to open this door, would you?
No. I didn't get where I am giving in to other people.
Didn't think so. But I wanted to make my point.
He shifted the shotgun back to cover the phys ed teacher.
Move your man back. Way you got this barrel chopped off, Spread's gonna get him too.
Conrad waved Saunders off. The sec man stepped backward, but kept his pistol lined up on the phys ed teacher's head. Pulling the metal stock into his shoulder and thrusting the abbreviated muzzle through the bars, Dean covered Solomon. There was still some question whether the weapon was actually loaded. It might all be a setup to scare the phys ed teacher. Dean prepared himself all the same, knowing he was willing to take the man's life for how he betrayed them. He curled his finger around the trigger. Solomon broke and tried to run. Dean rode out the recoil as the double-aught buckshot erupted from the muzzle and caught the man in mid-stride, knocking him flat at once.
You killed him! You crazy bastard!
Still in motion, Dean swung the shotgun on Conrad, catching the man by surprise. He squeezed the trigger, aiming directly at the man's head. Conrad didn't even flinch.
Empty.
See that?
Even if there'd been a shell in the chamber, you wouldn't have gotten out of the cage alive.
Dean made himself smile.
You said there was only one round. Had to find out if your word is worth anything. If it wasn't, better to get the dying over with now.
You got balls, kid, I'll give you that. You and me are gonna do just fine.
He held out a hand for the shotgun. Dean passed it across, glancing briefly at Solomon's corpse. He felt something, but he didn't let the feeling grow. He was going to have to stay hard, mean, if he wanted to live.
You other boys, listen up. Got an announcement I want to make before we leave here. Anybody so much as lays a hand on this boy, that person's going to answer to me. Then that person's going to die. That's a promise. Any questions? No? Good. Saunders, shut up this wag and make sure everything's secure.
Conrad stepped off the platform behind the cage, already thumbing loads into the Mossberg. Once the flaps had been dropped to cover the bars, Dean sank to his haunches and tried not to be sick. It was one thing to kill a man or a mutie that was trying to kill him, or kill an animal for food, but it was another to shoot a man just standing there looking at him. Dean's stomach rolled threateningly. His dad would have done it, though, and for just the same reasons he had.
You feel better, you bastard? Does killing an unarmed man get you off?
Ignoring Perry, Dean poked his fingers through the bars, finally able to get his whole hand through. He reached for the edge of the tarp covering the cage, trying to separate it.
Ease off on him.
Fuck you too, Lewis. If they put a gun in that bastard's hand and told him to chill us, what do you think he's gonna do?
What the hell's wrong with you, Ethan? You have a soft spot for old Solomon? Seems like you always was his favorite, and he liked looking at you in the shower.
Ah, fuck you, Hanley!
Perry lunged up, hands reaching for Hanley's throat. Several boys worked together to put Perry down, piling on top of him. Jordy Ferguson leveled his blue-eyed glare at Perry.
That it, Ethan? Old Solomon feeding you sausage in the can?
Get off!
Chance Montoya and Enrique Green held onto Perry's legs as he struggled. Chance elbowed him in the thigh.
Maybe you already forgot how Solomon sold us out. Me? I wasn't ever gonna forget. Ever. If Dean hadn't killed Solomon, maybe that man would have never got caught. I wouldn't have wanted to see that happen. What about you, Green?
I'd have killed him.
Damn it, let me go.
Lewis fixed Perry with a hard gaze that Dean could read even in the darkness.
Word to the wise, Perry. Don't try that again. Not to Bobby, not to Dean, not to any of us.
And if I do?
Then we'll chill you ourselves.
You think you're talking for all of them, you blonde bitch?
Yeah.
His fingers on the edge of the tarp, Dean hesitated. Boots still showed at the back of the wag. He waited, not wanting to risk getting caught and catching someone's wrath. He turned his attention to the boys at the other end of the wag, watching the shift of power from Perry to Lewis. Even Moxon moved to sit next to Lewis, glaring at Perry.
He is.
Dean was surprised. Lewis had always been the quietest and most pleasant of Perry's group. He hadn't seemed like leadership material.
You okay with that, Dean?
Yeah.
I put this group together. You're not gonna just push me out like that.
Solomon put this group together, and he named you leader. Look the fuck around. I, for one, am not too happy with where that has taken us.
You're gonna give me grief, and Dean just chilled Solomon?
I did it for a reason.
Why? Revenge?
They took us down with those trank guns and didn't make any sound that carried. A shotgun blast might have been heard back at the school, especially if Jake or Joel was on duty. Thought maybe they might come looking.
Then you should have missed Solomon.
I didn't want to. Maybe we aren't coming back from wherever they're taking us. I didn't want Solomon getting away with chilling all of us. I had another reason, too. We're gonna be noticed missing in the morning. Somebody'll come looking for us. If Conrad and his people leave Solomon's body where it is, it'll give whoever comes looking a chance to start searching in the right direction.
Lewis looked at Dean, a slight grin on his lips.
Slick. I wouldn't have thought about that.
Dean turned back to the bars and parted the tarp again. All the boys except Perry crowded around him, peering through the tarp as well. Outside, a sec man held a lantern, while two others lifted Solomon's body and threw it onto the wag.
Oh, guess they thought about it too.
Maybe, Connor. But there's the blood. Be harder to see, but they can't clean it all up. Not after what that shotgun did.
The wag lurched forward, banging the boys around. They spread out, everybody staying away from Perry. Settling back against the side of the wag and getting as comfortable as he could, Dean forced himself to relax and not think about killing Solomon. Moxon looked at him.
You think Brody will send somebody?
I don't know. If Brody gets word to my dad, I know he'll be there as soon as he can be.
And Dean hung on to that thought for comfort, not daring to ask himself how far away his dad might be at that moment.
I'm worried about Dean.
As dawn colored the eastern sky rose and gold, Christy lay naked on her lover's chest on the riverbank behind a copse of trees, within shouting distance of the other companions. Neither of them had any clothes on, pressing flesh against flesh, a blanket beneath them. Their weapons were within easy reach. Ryan stroked his hands gently up and down her back.
Can't lead these people to him. The Sekhmen and his troops are still after us. Me and Jack saw them in the distance. It's in our best interest to change courses.
I had a vision about Dean last night.
She gazed into Ryan's cobalt blue eye. It was red and bloodshot, mute testimony that he hadn't been getting enough rest.
In that vision, Dean looked sick, out somewhere in the open, so he couldn't be protected.
Was he still at the school?
I don't know. I couldn't see that.
Ryan pulled her closer and kissed her tenderly.
We'll get to him, Christy. That's what we're all out here for. Just can't see a way clear to do it yet. The river goes on another 15-20 miles before it switches back to the north and joins up with the Humboldt River, according to Hoyle. It might take us the wrong direction. Way the hell off the route we want to go.
I know. I looked at the map, too, when you and JB were going over things. We could hole up somewhere and hope Lamarck and his Baron miss us.
We could, but if we get caught out here, there's no defensible place we could hope to hold. Our best bet is movement. We'll catch a few hours sleep here, then push on before noon. Hoyle says the impact area where the space station is coming down is about 15 miles from here, according to JB's mini-sextant. We can make that by nightfall, maybe set up camp, see what we're left with next morning. Kron's ticking against Hardco and Lamarck. They gotta be getting onto this big game of theirs. Once they do, we'll be left alone.
We could be late getting to Dean.
I know. But it's all I can think of to do. I will protect him.
Christy kissed him softly and started moving on top of him, trying to ease both of their fears with lips against lips and skin against skin. He met her need with his own. She let herself go with the pleasure, waves of it crusting inside her, building to something even bigger. She concentrated on the here and now, not thinking about the dangers that still face them.